I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 7th of January. The temperature hit zero today. It was worth a round of applause. From the Gladstone Institute News, this headline, Gladstone scientists discover how key immune cells die during HIV infection and identify potential drug to block AIDS. Our guest this hour is Dr. Warner Green, Director of Virology and Immunology at the Gladstone Institutes in San Francisco. He and his researchers have recently published these findings, very important studies that could lead to new treatments and to help improve existing therapies for HIV infection and the potential to block AIDS. Dr. Green has been working in this field for a long time. He saw his first AIDS case in 1981, the year the disease was identified. And when he was an attending physician on the wards of San Francisco General Hospital, he says every single one of his patients had AIDS. There wasn't a thing that he could do about it. Every one of his patients died. So much has changed the past 30 years. These are important findings we'll be learning about today. And Dr. Green also has some warnings about prevention and how we may have been lulled into believing that AIDS is no longer very serious. It is. The global epidemic is far from over. It continues to expand, so he will discuss that as well. Dr. Warner Green is Director and Distinguished Professor of Translational Medicine of the Gladstone Institute of Virology and Immunology, the research center dedicated to studies of modern virology and immunology with a focus on HIV and AIDS. His research focuses on the molecular basis for HIV pathogenesis, transmission, and latency. He has written hundreds of scientific papers and has been recognized as one of the 100 most cited scientists. He became president in 2007 of the Accordia Global Health Foundation. The mission is to build alliances to fight infectious disease in Africa. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him during the course of this hour. And for you to reach the conversation, you can call 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And feel free to send us a message on our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Dr. Warner Green, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, Kathleen, it's a pleasure to join you this afternoon.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. And it must be a real pleasure to you after working and having so much death around you and trying to figure out what this disease was, to make these kinds of, I think it's safe to say, breakthroughs must make you feel as though your life's work has been worthwhile.
Well, I must say that it's been a fascinating voyage of discovery over the last several years as we've begun to try and attack the question of how the CD4 T cell dies. That is the fundamental issue in AIDS. And we knew, of course, that HIV could infect a CD4 T cell and that that productively infected cell, making new virus factories, that that cell would die. But what we also appreciated was there weren't enough of those virus-producing factories to explain the massive CD4 T cell losses.
Mm-hmm.
Something else was going on. And that's really what we've spent the last several years dissecting.
And tell me, what exactly is a CD4 T cell?
A CD4 T cell is it's also called a helper cell. Others have termed it the conductor of the immunological orchestra. Without the CD4 T cell, things in your immune system go completely haywire.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think AIDS, which destroys the CD4 T cells, emphasizes the pivotal importance of this cell to a normal immune response.
So you have found that some of the cells become virus replicating cells, but there are some other cells that you call resisting cells?
So these are, all right, so they're resting cells.
Resting cells.
So if you took a lymph node, a lymph node is a part of the lymphatic system. It's where the virus grows. And say you took 100 cells from that lymph node, about 5 of them would be able, due to a state of activation, to be able to support the production of new virus. They get infected, they make new virus, and that virus can spread. 95% of the cells will get infected with the virus. The virus will enter, but because they're resting, they are, do not support full viral replication, and the whole process aborts. It aborts at the level of where the RNA is being converted into DNA. Little pieces of DNA accumulate in the cytoplasm, and then the cell that's being infected or abortively infected recognizes that it has foreign DNA in its cytoplasm and launches an immune response against that DNA. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it is this host response against the virus that is causing the death of most CD4 T cells.
Mm-hmm.
So the depletion is much more of a suicide than it is a murder.
Mm-hmm. So what was the drug that you worked with, and what effect did it have on those cells?
Okay. So the pathway of death, so there were several surprises along the way. First, that the resting cells were becoming abortively infected. Second, that death was linked to a host response against the virus rather than some toxic effect of the virus itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third surprise was the death pathway that was utilized. Previously, almost all of the cell death associated with HIV infection, there was a very silent form of programmed cell death that had been implicated. But what we found was that in these resting CD4 T cells, that they were activating a very fiery form of cell death, full of inflammation, that was called called pyrotosis, pyro for fire. And the key enzyme in this pyrotosis pathway is an enzyme called caspase 1. And to our pleasure, when we discovered that caspase 1 was pivotal to this death pathway and began looking for caspase 1 inhibitors, it turned out that caspase 1 inhibitors had been developed for other reasons and had already been shown to be safe in humans. So it was like potentially being able to take a huge jump, bypassing the whole drug discovery part that can take years, to actually, if we're lucky, we can get into clinical trials very quickly with these caspase 1 inhibitors.
How did you know, Dr. Green, where to look? You've been in this field for years and years and years. How did you know?
Well, I think it's a very good question of why, you know, you've been studying HIV for, you know, we've known about the virus for 25 years. Why has this death pathway not been detected? Well, it hasn't been detected because we've been studying the wrong cells.
Hmm.
It's really, really important to go to the lymphoid tissue to study lymphocytes that reside within the lymphoid tissue as opposed to blood, to see this death pathway play out. And I think that was a key decision. It was an absolute key decision that we made. I'd like to think it was a really conscious decision, but we were interested in studying the primary CD4 T cells that were most relevant to HIV infection, and we did reason that that was in the lymphoid tissue. So it's harder to get this lymphoid tissue. You know, there are two national tissue distribution centers, and we're probably one of their heaviest users, I would guess, that we get tons of tonsil. And occasionally we get a spleen from someone who's had to have surgery for an emergency splenectomy.
Mm-hmm.
But the availability of these lymphoid tissues has been instrumental in our progress.
And also somebody had to decide, it's interesting how we make decisions, well, why don't we look at this? We haven't looked at it before, but let's look at it now. Somebody made that decision. It came to them.
I don't recall exactly what happened there, because it's been about 10 years ago that we started these studies. Another colleague in the laboratory was the first to develop what's called the lymphoid histoculture system, and we carried on those studies. But then, it got very, very interesting once it was clear that the virus was entering the cell and setting up this abortive infection. And then we've studied, there's two additional papers that are tracking these first two that we've published, and one of those will show that blood cells, which have been used in 99.9% of HIV studies, that blood CD4 T cells don't die by this mechanism. They are resistant to pyroptosis because they lack the DNA sensor that triggers the response. That was the subject of the science paper that we published, the identification of the DNA sensor that triggers the pyrotic pathway.
So these clinical trials that you would like to start as soon as possible would mean what? How would they be conducted?
Well, I think there's two types of questions that one can ask. I think the most, we have now over 30 antiviral drugs that have completely transformed the landscape of HIV care.
30 of those, really?
30 antiretroviral drugs. This will go down in medical history as a real landmark in terms of the systematic development of these antiviral drugs. When HIV hit, we had no drugs that would work. And in fact, that was what was so decimating. In the summer of in 1991, when I was on the wards at San Francisco General Hospital, watching all of my patients just die chasing one opportunistic infection after another with no hope for a cure. Then in the mid-90s, the combination antiretroviral therapy emerged, and finally we could suppress the virus to undetectable levels in many subjects. And that has really transformed. People, the quality of their lives improved, certainly the quantity of their lives improved. It was transformative.
Mm-hmm.
HIV and AIDS now, well, we don't see AIDS as much anymore. HIV infection is managed as an outpatient, it's a chronic, more like diabetes than cancer. What we do see, though, in the HIV-infected population that is somewhat alarming to me or concerning to me is that individuals are dying. They appear to be developing diseases of aging, but at a much younger age, perhaps 10 to 15 years earlier than expected. So, for example, heart disease, various lung disease, dementia, various forms of cancer. So individuals with HIV infection in the United States are now not dying of AIDS. They're dying of these diseases that we normally see in aging individuals, but they seem to be cropping up at an earlier time point. Could be that that's related to a low level of persistent inflammation in the body. Could be that it's related in some way to the drugs that are being used to control the virus. We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But this whole connection between aging a faster and susceptibility to diseases of aging and HIV infection, well treated, is a very hot topic in the field right now.
Mm-hmm. Are you studying that?
Yes, we are. And that brings me back to I mentioned the word inflammation, and I also mentioned that how pyroptosis, the death pathway by which HIV kills the CD4, these resting CD4 T cells, that is associated with very high levels of inflammation. We are very interested in exploring whether or not in subjects on antiretroviral drugs, so they're taking combinations of the 30 magic bullets, whether or not there is still some low-level CD4 T-cell demise by the small amounts of virus that is produced, and whether that is producing enough pyroptosis to explain or at least contribute in a significant way to the low-level chronic inflammation observed in these subjects.
Mm-hmm.
If it is, and if that's driving the aging problem, well, then one might be able to nip that in the bud with the caspase-1 inhibitor, which would block out that pathway, and therefore it would be a nice adjunct to the antiretroviral therapy that is so successful.
Mm-hmm. And is there a possibility that you could use the new drug to block AIDS, or do we not know?
All right, so then that's all right, so just the new drug by itself.
Right.
So I'm very intrigued by that possibility. I'm very intrigued from the point of view that currently there are 35.3 million people in the world who are HIV infected. 26 million of those, by WHO criteria, deserve immediate antiretroviral treatment. treatment, and we're only reaching 10 million of them. So there's 16 million people whose disease is progressing, and they're slowly and steadily dying, but they can't access antiretroviral therapy. So could I always envision that maybe a caspase 1 inhibitor like this could be used to kind of shelter in place, stop the virus from killing the CD4 T cells, block down some of the inflammation. Maybe it would be a way of checking, a temporizing measure that could be used until individuals can access more definitive antiretroviral treatment. Of course, that whole question, is it scalable? Is it cheap enough? Can we distribute it throughout the developing world? Will it be very safe, very well tolerated? All of those issues are still question marks, in that this drug has been in humans, but only for 6 weeks.
During
that period of time, it was shown to be quite safe and well tolerated. But we don't know what would happen if people were taking this drug for many, many months or a few years.
Mm-hmm. And why is it that there's still so many millions of people who can't get access to the antiretroviral drugs?
Well, it's a distribution problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, the programs like the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, which, in my opinion, is one of the most impressive foreign assistance programs the United States has ever launched. It will result in the saving of millions and millions of lives. It is going great guns, as is the Global Fund, but in total, we're only reaching 10 million of the 26 million. And, you know, we are maxed in terms of the amount of money that is dedicated to this. There's just, you know, there are more infections than there are capacity to get the drugs to individuals. So it's getting much, much better, but that's part of my, this epidemic is by no means over. It continues to expand, and for every 10 people that we put on antiretroviral therapy in Africa, 16 new people become newly infected. So we don't have a winning strategy yet. But I can't emphasize enough what an incredible job PEPFAR and Global Fund are doing and what a difference that they are making.
We welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Dr. Warner Green, director and senior investigator at the Gladstone Institute at Gladstone University in San Francisco, California. He is a professor of medicine, microbiology, immunology at UC San Francisco and co-director of the UCSF GIVI Center for AIDS Research. He's been in this field, as I said at the beginning of the show, since the first AIDS case was discovered back in 1981 and has been working in the field ever since. These are important findings. And we're talking about the studies that were published just recently, Gladstone scientists discovering how key immune cells die during HIV infection and identified this potential drug to block AIDS. He's described what it would do. We'll move into a conversation of how we can achieve an AIDS-free generation. What about work on a vaccine now? What about public knowledge about AIDS? In an interview not that long ago, he talked about the fact that we may have been lulled into believing that AIDS is no longer a problem because we have these antiretroviral drugs. But indeed, the number of people who are infected is increasing, as he just said. So what do we need to do to prevent transmission? What understanding do we need now about what activities might be risky, when it's important to get tested, when is the right time to start with those antiretroviral drugs, et cetera? Here's our phone number. Join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'll be with you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Dr. Warner Green, Director of Virology and Immunology at the Gladstone Institutes in San Francisco, and we start our calls with Valerie in Cross Plains. Hi, Valerie.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Dr. Gladstone, it's a real honor to speak with you.
His name is Dr. Green. He's from the Gladstone Institute.
So I had a question, which is if a young person in college was interested in doing the type of work that you do, what would you suggest as their career path?
Oh, that's an interesting question, Valerie. I think that the best approach is to complete college, and then you have a fork in the road, and that fork in the road would be to either go to medical school or to go to graduate school. If you go to medical school, you would be obtaining an MD. If you go to graduate school, you would be aiming toward a PhD. And I actually wound up doing both. I did a combined MD-PhD program, which I found to be fascinating. So you can either access biomedical research through the MD route or through the PhD route. The PhD route is a little bit more of a direct line between the two points and allows really highly focused studies. It takes about 6 years to get your PhD, and then there will be another 2 to 3 years, 4 years perhaps as a postdoctoral fellow, and before you actually get your first job. So it's a fair amount of training, but well worth it.
Well, thank you very much. I just find it fascinating, and I appreciate the program.
Thanks, Valerie. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Bill in Oshkosh. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I'm very interested in what you said about President Obama's initiative. Could you describe that and how it's organized and where it's going, perhaps?
Sure. So actually, PEPFAR did not originate with President Obama. It was actually George Bush who created the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief and implemented it. I think it is actually one of the striking jewels in the Bush presidency. I mean, in terms of what will ultimately be accomplished, it's amazing. So the PEPFAR continues. Ambassador Eric Goosby was Ambassador Mark Dybul was the first head of PEPFAR, followed by Eric Goosby, who just within the last few months, stepped down. And we're awaiting the appointment of the new head of the Office of the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator. But PEPFAR is now probably, it's treating millions of individuals. It's celebrating its 10th birthday. And it has clearly prevented, for example, 1 million new infections in children. However, no time to rest on our laurels because last year over 200,000 children were infected with HIV in the developing world. So much more to be done, but PEPFAR is an amazing organization.
Thank you, Bill, very much for your call. Our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. I was reading an interview with you, Dr. Green. It was maybe last year. I don't know if things have improved much, but you did have some important comments. You talked about new infections among young gay and bisexual men in this country increasing 22% from 2007 to 2010. People aren't getting tested. Some who do get tested are not on antiretroviral drugs. 59% of HIV-positive Americans, 13 to 24, unaware of the fact that they were infected. These are pretty dramatic statistics, aren't they?
Right. Well, that's the reason that I wrote that particular op-ed, was to try and raise awareness about this epidemic, even both here in the United States as well as throughout the developing world, most significantly in sub-Saharan Africa. There was a time in Washington, D.C. when when in fact it was the HIV infection rates surpassed that of many capitals of sub-Saharan Africa. We have a continuing, you know, infection rate that really hasn't changed here in the United States for the last 10 years. I mean, in terms of it hasn't gotten better. It's in fact, it's getting worse. So yet everyone, there seems to be a certain lack of regard for this infection now that the antiretroviral medicines have emerged. Everyone has kind of the misimpression that, that if they got the virus, they could be cured. There is no scalable cure for HIV. There's a few isolated individuals who have been cured. But in general, if you're infected, once infected, always infected, and your only recourse is to take the antiretroviral medicines for the rest of your life. So my message is that it's critical for our youth to be aware of this virus and to take steps, to take active steps to prevent themselves from becoming infected.
We'll talk about those active steps in a moment, but why is it that we haven't kept conducting public campaigns to understand how many more people are getting infected and how to keep from getting infected? What happened to the public campaign for knowledge?
Well, I think there's, I mean, it's just, it's a question of priorities. In the mid-90s, the early 90s, certainly HIV was center stage. Now with the medicines, it's been pushed off the stage, mm-hmm. yet it continues to be an omnipresent problem. It's a problem particularly within our youth, particularly within individuals of color. And, you know, I don't think it should be pushed off the center stage. We need to deal effectively with this virus. Unfortunately, we don't have a vaccine, and we don't have a cure, a scalable cure. So, and those are the two goals. Those are the two high priority goals of the HIV research agenda now is to come up with a vaccine and to come up with a cure. And I think significant progress is being made on both fronts.
Mm-hmm. And why is the vaccine, you've been dealing with this for a long, long time. We've been talking about the possibility of a vaccine for a long, long time. Is there something about AIDS that makes a vaccine more difficult to develop?
Yes. Well, first and foremost, one issue is that the virus attacks the conductor of the immunological orchestra. So if you kill off the conductor, it's hard for the orchestra to get going and to actually play mm-hmm. anything meaningful. So in other words, the virus, by targeting the CD4 T cell, destroys the immune response that was necessary to create the state of immunity. But perhaps even more important is the variability of the virus. Every time HIV replicates, it makes an error. And so it's just generating out just completely, you know, slightly different copies of itself. So there's not such a thing as a species of HIV. There is a swarm. There's millions and millions and millions of different types of HIV. So the virus is able to rapidly adapt to an immune response or to a single drug, and become resistant to that vaccine, that immune response or that drug. It's only through the use of combinations of antiretroviral drugs that we've actually been able to get a hold on HIV. No single drug works well, and there can be almost the predictable emergence of resistance to single drugs. So it's high mutability, it's attack on the CD4 T cells, and it's those are the issues that really confront us in terms of a successful vaccine.
But when you say, Dr. Green, that we're making progress on that front, can you explain that?
Oh. Yeah. So,
oh, good.
We know. I think most in the field agree now that we need we need to utilize both arms of the immune system. And by that I mean the T-cell immunity. These are the cytotoxic T-cells that hunt and out and destroy virally infected cells. But we also need the antibodies, the humoral part of the immune system, the antibodies that would bind to and neutralize the virus. We've long known how to make pretty good cytotoxic T-cells against HIV. What we've lacked is progress in terms of making broadly neutralizing antibodies against HIV. And as I think Tony Fauci said at a recent conference, 2013 will go down as a year of significant HIV vaccine progress. Lots of new information about neutralizing antibodies, broadly neutralizing antibodies, new information about the structure of the dominant of the envelope, which is where most of the antibodies are directed. So lots of really positive steps, none that have yet transferred down to an effective vaccine. Although, you know, there was the Thai vaccine trial, RV-144, that was the first vaccine trial to show a minimal, just barely statistically significant effect at the end of the trial. But if you look at that trial earlier, it looked like there was pretty good protection early on that waned. So many in the field think that there's a clue there, and that what we need to be working on is maintaining the type of immunity that occurred early on in that RV-144 trial. Mm-hmm. But so there's glimmers of hope all over the place. There's progress being made. I'm bolder about an HIV vaccine, the potential success, successful development of one, than I've been in a long time.
Mm. And then there are your studies just recently published, and those are significant advancements.
Our studies really deal with the fundamental pathogenesis of how the CD4 T cell is destroyed. Now, it's potentially possible that our studies, potentially, and I want to underline, potentially possible that our studies would contribute toward a cure if, in fact, inflammation is driving the maintenance of the latent reservoir of virus, which is why we can't cure anyone with our antiretroviral drugs. If inflammation is driving the maintenance of that reservoir and the low-level pyrotosis that would be continuing is generating the appropriate inflammatory environment, then it's possible that this T cell death, the linkage between T cell death and inflammation, is contributing to maintenance of the reservoir. That is something that we can test in HIV infected subjects. It would be a high priority for the in the clinical trial of the caspase-1 inhibitor.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know whether that will be the case or not.
When will you know?
Well, that's a good question, Kathleen. I'm eager to launch these clinical studies, both of the drug by itself as well as the drug in combination with antiretroviral therapy. We're in negotiations with the drug company that has produced this particular caspase-1 inhibitor, and I hope that will be successful in the coming weeks.
Our guest this hour is Dr. Warner Green. He's Director of Virology and Immunology at the Gladstone Institutes in San Francisco, and just said something very important. His studies have been published just recently, and from the whole process that he's been describing, it looks as though once they get this into clinical trials, he's hopeful that one of the discoveries could be a potential cure for AIDS. It's amazing to even say that, a potential cure for AIDS. He's been in this field for a long time. He saw his first AIDS case in 1981 when the disease was identified, and has been working all these years since, studying the disease and coming up with public knowledge campaigns, public service campaigns, but most importantly, the science behind all of this that has allowed people to live. It saves so many lives, but there is much to be done. We welcome your questions about their studies, about a vaccine, about more information about his study. And what about this whole issue? I'm interested in our audience's response to this. Do you think that we need to increase public knowledge about the ramifications of getting infected? Do we understand that? Do we know what safe sex is now? Has it changed dramatically over the years that we've known about AIDS? What activities are risky, or have we been lulled into a complacency about all of this because we have antiretroviral drugs now, and so we figure, well, it's not a death sentence anymore. You can live with this. But now, as you heard him say, there are problems with early onset of age-related disease if you're on those drugs. So it's a field, huh? It's quite a field. So here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to go that route, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For you to join this conversation, Dr. Warner Green is our guest, Director of Virology and Immunology Research at the Gladstone Institutes in San Francisco. If you have questions about their remarkable findings, their research that has been published recently, or a general conversation about where we are in understanding AIDS and in preventing AIDS, we'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Dr. Green, email from someone who said that she wanted to know if Henrietta Lacks cells are being used in any of the studies on HIV or AIDS.
Oh, that's interesting. So these are HeLa cells, and in general, we don't use HeLa cells in the studies of HIV because they lack the appropriate receptors to become infected with the virus. That said, that I've certainly used HeLa cells throughout my career in various stages of the research, but none of the current HIV research depended upon HeLa cells.
Mm-hmm. That was a fascinating book, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, fascinating. All right, let's talk a little bit about how we need to increase public knowledge. You've said if everybody had all the facts and understood the grave ramifications of getting infected, we would do a better job of preventing transmission, understanding what activities are risky, when it's important to get tested, and when it's the right time to start with those drugs. So what do we need to know about preventing transmission and understanding what activities are risky?
Well, I think, this is a sexually transmitted disease. You only need to look, portions of our society that are having the most sex are at the greatest risk for acquiring this virus, unless they take measures to prevent that acquisition. And, condoms work, but unfortunately, people don't use condoms with the kind of regularity that they need to. We're understanding that, of course, mother to child transmission is a very concerning form of transmission of the virus. But the good news there is, here in San Francisco, I don't know exactly the statistic, but we've not had a case of pediatric acquisition of the virus in 10 or 15 years.
Oh, that's great.
Because the mothers are getting placed on antiretroviral drugs, and then therapy is being, continued after the baby is born while the mom is breastfeeding. So, it's we can markedly prevent a mother to child transmission of this virus if we get the mothers on appropriate treatment and continue mother and baby on treatment for a period after during breastfeeding. So, I just think I've used the term AIDS fatigue. I think that there's just a general fatigue about the virus, a misconception that the problem is dealt with. It's anything but dealt with. 70% of new infections in the world are occurring in sub-Saharan Africa, and the virus continues to spread there. Now, there is good news, though. There is good news. 13 African countries have now decreased their HIV or have declining HIV infection rates. So, I mean, that's really good news. To some extent, the continuing expansion of the global HIV epidemic is more a reflection, that there's still new infections occurring, but it's mostly driven by the fact that more people are getting on antiretroviral therapy and are living longer and therefore not dying.
Mm-hmm.
We're starting to turn the corner. I mean, but we haven't reached that tipping point by any means. And so, it's what are the effective preventions that we have? Condoms, but people don't use them. We have circumcision. Circumcision is over 70% protective from a male acquiring HIV from an infected female. If we had a 70% effective vaccine, we would be deploying it instantaneously. Currently, we're trying to scale up circumcisions in sub-Saharan Africa. There are lots of issues surrounding circumcision. So far, about over 3.2 million circumcisions have been performed. We'd hope to be at the 20 million level at this point. But progress is being made. It's great. It's great.
Mm-hmm.
The microbicides, first woman-controlled approach, and they're showing some effect, about a 50% at best effect. So we need much better microbicides. One of the really exciting areas is treatment as prevention. So people that are at high risk who are uninfected, can take a pill a day and prevent themselves from acquiring HIV. That's the chemoprophylaxis. That's the IPREC study that was actually published by Bob Grant out of Gladstone.
Mm.
And then there's the other approach is that you can use treatment if you treat HIV-infected individuals and reduce their viral load, then they are much less likely to transmit the virus to others. So chemoprophylaxis would suggest treating the uninfected high-risk person, whereas treatment as prevention really goes and treats the individual who's infected to prevent the spread.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these, now that the idea in terms of the prevention area is to try and combine all of these modalities, use everything that we've got in the shop to try and to get a hold on reducing the transmission rates of HIV. And studies are now underway asking whether combination prevention, just like combination antiretrovirals was so effective, whether combination prevention will be the way forward.
An email from Paul. Does the research, your research, look to be extendable to other retroviruses like the herpes family, including chickenpox and shingles, as well as other diseases, or other diseases entirely, including maybe cancer?
So I don't think that our studies are immediately translatable to other viruses. I think that these are unique characteristics. The parotidic pathway, et cetera, is a unique characteristic of the abortive infection seen in CD4 T cells. Now, I don't exclude that other viruses might also be elicit. I mean, and other viruses do elicit pyrotosis. Herpes viruses probably are not, they're not killing their host cells in this mechanism. They're not really the same kind of, very different. It's a DNA-based virus as opposed to an RNA-based virus. So quite a different situation there.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that we may be suffering from a kind of AIDS fatigue, which keeps us from lowering those numbers of new cases. Do you, as a researcher or people you have worked with over these many years, ever suffer from a kind of researcher fatigue, or is the quest to find a cure for this and a vaccine just so strong that you will keep working on it as long as you have to?
Well, I have to say, I mean, no, my passion for working on HIV is unabated. The fire burns bright.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, progress, the fact that we're making progress on so many, and by we I mean the field, is making progress on so many fronts is really heartening. And but it is difficult sometimes when organizations, one of the big ways in which biomedical research organizations maintain their funding in times of difficulty like we are in now in terms of when NIH funding is down, is through philanthropy. And I can tell you that it is very difficult to get individuals engaged around HIV/AIDS from a philanthropic point of view. And I find that I think it's because still there is a stigma associated with this virus and the disease that it causes. But I tell you that HIV/AIDS and its study has taught us so much about cell biology, so much about so many different aspects of biology have stemmed from the studies of HIV that have benefited so many different areas. But it is a little frustrating that, when you're talking to donors and they just kind of turn off, they tune out.
Mm-hmm.
When, in fact, you're so passionate about what you're talking about, but they're not interested.
Mm. Well, they just need to hear you speak. Then they'll become interested. Well, and it's such a different world, too. I'm trying to imagine, Dr. Green, I can't imagine how hard it is to be a doctor, but thinking back to you in the 90s when all the people who were in your care died because nobody knew what to do, that must have been just terrible.
Oh, this was worse than, this was the most depressing. That first month, after I moved to San Francisco, the first month I was on the wards was probably the hardest time in the medical part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Literally every patient admitted to my medical service at San Francisco General Hospital was infected with HIV, and they were all dying.
Mm.
And it was horrible. But that situation, but San Francisco, people like Merle Sandy, Paul Volberding, Connie Wolfsey, they pioneered the San Francisco approach, the care model for HIV-infected individuals. And San Francisco General Hospital is still recognized as one of the most outstanding places in the country to be cared for with a HIV infection. So, it's been a privilege to work here at UCSF and at San Francisco General Hospital. I've seen the bad times of this virus. I'm continuing to see how this virus is impacting sub-Saharan Africa, but I have great hopes for the future. I have hopes for a cure, and I have hopes for a vaccine that will really change the arithmetic of this infection.
May this be the year those hopes are realized. And Dr. Warner Green, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I guess this hour, Dr. Warner Green, he's director of virology and immunology research at the Gladstone Institutes in San Francisco, and they had a couple very important studies that were published just a couple weeks ago, and one may play out as being potentially a cure for AIDS, so it's an extremely important discovery. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour and for his on-air production of this hour as well. And thanks for your involvement. We'll be with you hour number two of the program talking about child soldiers. So please stay with us. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.